Welcome to the People's Historian Podcast with the Zinn Education Project, coordinated by Teaching for Change and Rethinking Schools. I'm Jesse Hagopian, a co-editor of Rethinking Schools and host of this series on Teach the Black Freedom Struggle. Today, Rethinking Schools Executive Director Sierra Kaler Jones and I speak with historian Michael Hines about his book, A Worthy Piece of Work, The Untold Story of Madeline Morgan and the Fight for Black History in Schools. So let's jump in. Thank you so much for being with us here tonight.
Thank you so much for the invite. It's lovely to be here.
Right on.
What a fantastic book. I know I learned so much, and there were so many pieces of Madeline Morgan's story that I had never learned before, and I also just resonated deeply with. So thank you so much for this incredible text. I'm excited to dive in. So what encouraged and inspired you to highlight Madeline Morgan's story? How did you first learn about her?
So I first came to Madeline Morgan during the process of writing my dissertation. I got my PhD in 2017 from Loyola University Chicago, and this book really grew out of that work. So when I sort of started looking for a dissertation topic, I had a couple of things front of mind. First, I wanted to study something local. Chicago has this incredibly rich heritage when it comes to Black history. You can think about the contributions the city's made to Black music, you know, art, literature. I wanted to find some of the educational roots of some of that. And then second, I wanted to tell a story that looked at Black education before Brown versus Board. So there's a lot of incredible scholarship that's been written on those sort of like tragedies and triumphs of the post-Brown world of the desegregation era of school integration. But my interest as a historian was a little bit earlier. So the early 20th century, late 19th centuries. With those sort of things in place, those sort of interest in place, I started looking for a topic and, you know, just really listening, because in Chicago, we have this really great tradition of Black historians, people like Timuel Black, who just passed at the age of 102 in 2021. And, you know, just these amazing historians with this deep knowledge of Chicago's Black history. And so I was fortunate enough to sit with a man named Christopher Robert Reed. He was a professor at Roosevelt University. He wrote some of the first histories of Black Chicago. And, you know, I really heard Madeline Morgan's name for the first time sitting in his office, just trying to keep up with the stories he was telling, right? And, you know, he started talking about this teacher, and I thought to myself, you know, this can't be possible, right? She's doing Black history work in the 1940s. And this is before culturally sustaining pedagogy. This is before, you know, culturally relevant teaching. This is before multiculturalism. This is before Black studies and multicultural studies. It's before school integration, right? And so that interested me. And that question of like, how did that happen really sort of drove, you know, my dissertation and what became the book.
Yeah. I'm so glad you wrote this book. I realized the huge gap in my understanding of the struggle for Black education when I read it. I'd read stuff about Woodson, and then stuff about the McCarthy era attacking Black studies, but there's that gap in between there that I really didn't know much about. So I really appreciated that. And I was hoping you could give us a biographical sketch of Madeline Morgan, her early life, her education, and her organizational experiences that helped equip her with the skills that she would go on to use to become a champion for teaching for Black lives in her own day.
Yeah. So, So I think Madeline Morgan, I think first and foremost, she's a child of the Great Migration. So she's born in Chicago, but her father, John Henry Robinson, is a Southern migrant from West Virginia. Her mother, Stella Mae Dixon, is what Chicagoans call an old settler, which is sort of the term for Black folks who can trace their families back, you know, to the 19th century. And she grows up on the south side of Chicago, where a majority of the new migrants in the Great Migration land in this area that's known as the Black Belt. But during this period, it's getting renamed by Black folks themselves, right? And they're giving it the name Bronzeville, which is what it's known as today. And I think it's, you know, really important that ability for self-determination and self-fashioning that we're seeing grow in this period on the south side of Chicago and in Bronzeville. So she grows up seeing Black folks telling their own stories, right? Whether that's through the Black press, like the Chicago Defender, the Chicago Bee, you know, whether it's through literature. I mean, you know, there's Langston Hughes coming through the city, Gwendolyn Brooks, Richard Wright, you know, whether it's through cultural institutions, you know, you can think about the George Cleveland Hall branch of the Chicago Libraries. And I think, you know, the Chicago Defender had this quote referring to Black Chicagoans that said, you know, they make their own wit, their own music, they form their own views, they live their own lives. They do not constitute the fringe of white society. They are the nucleus of another society, right? So she's growing up in that really rich tradition. And then at the same time, she's going through formal systems of schooling where those stories are completely left out. So, you know, when she goes to high school at Inglewood High School, which is back then was predominantly Irish, you know, she's getting no Black history there. When she goes to the Chicago Normal College to learn how to become a teacher, this, you know, ostensibly progressive institution where she trains, she has teachers tell her that they've never heard of a contribution to American history being made by a Black person, right? When she goes to Northwestern, where she gets her master's degree, right? It's the same thing. So I think it's really like the tension between those two things. You know, the stories that she knows are there. And then, you know, these structures that are telling her that, you know, we've never heard of this, right? This doesn't exist. That really start to drive her to think about these things in a new way.
Right on.
Wow, that's so powerful. And I love how you're lifting up self-determination, telling our own stories in our own words. And I love that Madeline Morgan really grew up in the spirit of that, and that then permeated and transitioned into her work and her teaching. And so you write, white supremacy and anti-Black racism were deeply embedded in the curriculum of America's schools in the early 20th century, particularly in history and social studies. So can you give us examples of how schools and textbooks portrayed Black history, starting from the Reconstruction era through to the early 20th century?
I'm sure. So I think, first of all, it's important to set the context, right? When we're talking about race and portrayals of race in textbooks in the early 20th century, they're reflecting and they're reinforcing the racism that's just prevalent in the broader society, right? So white supremacy and anti-Blackness were endemic to society in the early 20th century, right? From science, we can think about social Darwinism, the rise of the eugenics movement. It's in popular literature, right? The first Tarzan book comes out in 1912. We can think about early film. The Birth of a Nation premieres in 1915, right? It's everywhere. It's down to children's songs and nursery rhymes, right? I have a 2.5-year-old you know, who just started singing 10 Little Monkeys Jumping on the Bed, right? And I was like, oh God, because I know where that song originated from, right? And I know it was 10 Little Negroes, except the word wasn't Negro, right? So it was everywhere. It was very, very prevalent. It was in the water. And then supporting all of that and reinforcing all of that is the official knowledge that's portrayed in schools. So Black people are being characterized as lazy, as unintelligent, as violent, as predatory, as lascivious. I mean, and all of those images help to sort of undergird oppression, right? Whether it's oppression in the past, like slavery, or whether it's ongoing oppression, like lynching and segregation. So, you know, I'll say there's a quote. It was very interesting to do the research for this book because I had to do a lot of reading in very old textbooks. And I pulled a couple of examples. The first is a description of slavery from Daniel B. Beattie's America's Roots in the Past, which is in 1927. And he says, you know, on the tobacco plantations of Maryland, Virginia, and North Carolina, the slaves were usually treated kindly, the climate was healthful, and the labor of growing tobacco was easy. The work was so simple that it was well suited to unskilled workers. Even when an overseer was employed to direct the slaves, the work was more or less under the master's observation, and he usually lived on his plantation year round. In winter, the slaves' life was easy. Their work consisted of clearing a piece of land, cutting wood for the fireplace in the master's mansion, and caring for the livestock. So, I mean, those are the sort of portrayals, right? You know, a second one from Ruth and Wilson West, The Story of Our Country, which was in the Chicago schools in 1935. They called the Ku Klux Klan a secret society who, quote, dressed like ghosts in mask and long white robes, rode around at night, warning the terrified Negroes to behave themselves and to let government affairs alone. So these are the descriptions that were just par for the course throughout the period that we're talking about.
Wow. I mean, it hurts my heart. And what is even more painful is to see some of those types of portrayals coming back in our schools, like in Florida, now official state curriculum saying that slavery was of, quote, personal benefit.
Yes.
Right. I mean, to that mind-boggling ignorance can only be understood when you know the history of U.S. curriculum, that this is not the first time that this, right, everything you write about, they've developed these types of ideas for a long time.
Right. Echoes of past curricula. Yeah.
No doubt. And you write about the early history of this Black history movement. And you say that, quote, Morgan's efforts in the Chicago schools were part of a larger wave of scholarship and activism aimed at the preservation and promotion of Black history in the early 20th century, an intellectual and social project that historian Pitro Dogbovi terms the, quote, early Black history movement. So I was hoping you could talk about some of the highlights of that movement to teach Black history even before Madeline Morgan's time.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this movement goes back. I mean, Black educators have been teaching Black history for as long as Black people have been in this country, right? But formally in the schools, I think we can trace the movement back to the work of people like Edward A. Johnson in the late 19th century, who writes a school history of the Negro race in like 1891, 92. You know, people like Lila Amos Pendleton, a teacher in DC who wrote a narrative of the Negro in 1912. So this is a movement that's been ongoing. And I think what's different about the 1920s to 1940s that sort of solidifies it into this movement is that it becomes really far-reaching, really deep, more extensive, better organized. And, you know, a name that we've already, you know, said tonight, I think, is responsible for that, right? It's in large part the result of Carter G. Woodson in the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History. And so Woodson puts together this, you know, this machine, right? And it's still going, it's still going strong, right? But this machine for the documentation and the dissemination of Black history, and the association launches, you know, academic journals, right? The Journal of Negro History is holding annual meetings. It's putting scholarship out there. You know, they're working in the schools through the Negro History Bulletin. You know, and of course, the effort that most people are familiar with, which is the Negro History Week movement that becomes, you know, Black History Month that we know today. And so that's really the engine that's driving this movement during Madeline Morgan's time. And she's a part of the association and she really leans on the association because I think it's important to recognize that while, you know, Carter G. Woodson was the head of the movement, right, the people who were out in the trenches doing the work day to day were these Black teachers, the majority of whom were Black women, right, who are really carrying this and interpreting it and giving it to kids and to communities.
I love that. Shout out to the Black women teachers. And I just appreciate you for
shout out, Mom. Lifting.
Yes. I just appreciate you for lifting up that and lifting up the everyday ordinary people that do the organizing and that are part of the struggle and that are leading the struggle in so many different local contexts. And so I want to talk a little bit about the intercultural movement. So this intercultural movement that got going in education in the run-up to World War II that you talk about in the book was really fascinating to us. So can you explain how World War II helped to create the conditions that led to the intercultural movement?
Yeah. So by the 1930s, I think the early Black history movement is grown, it's expanded, but it's still very much contained within segregated Black schools. And what changes, I think, in the late 1930s, early 1940s, is that there's another movement called intercultural education that provides this window for Black teachers to bring some of their thinking to bear and into sort of the mainstream of American education. So the intercultural education movement, it's also called the tolerance education movement, really begins post-World War I and then really gets going in the lead up to World War II. And it's concerned mostly with bringing together the sons and daughters of mostly white immigrants, right? Germans, Irish, Italians, Poles, right? Into this sort of united American whole, right? And as World War II, you know, is looming on the horizon and the threat of fascism is there, you know, educators start picking up on this need for interculturalism in the schools. And what Black teachers, I think, immediately recognize is that there's an opportunity here, right? America is trying to portray itself as, you know, the beacon of democracy, equality, inclusivity, right? And Black teachers are going, okay, we can use that, right? We can use that same rhetoric, right? And we can turn it to argue for the importance of Black history as part of this broader American story, right? And so they're basically calling out the hypocrisy of what's going on. And I think that happens a lot during the Second World War, whether you want to talk about, you know, the first March on Washington movement with A. Philip Randolph, whether you want to talk about, you know, the movement to desegregate the military. You can look at civil rights pushes in nursing, in, you know, war work. You know, there's so many. I think that the civil rights movement during the 40s really lays the groundwork for what's going to follow in the 50s, right? It's no surprise that that school integration becomes this issue in the early 1950s because this groundwork has been being laid in the 30s and 40s. So she's really taking advantage of that.
Yeah. Yeah, no doubt. I love how Morgan saw this opening, like, oh, you all want to talk about different cultures, but you don't want to include Black people. That's not going to work. So let me open up some space here. And we're going to include Black people in the many cultures that make up this country. And she went farther to actually create a curriculum that educators in Chicago could use to teach Black history. I think she called it the supplementary units for the course of instruction in social studies. Mm-hmm. And so I was hoping you could talk about how she launched this movement and what was in that curriculum and, you know, some of the struggles she had to go through to get it implemented.
Yeah. So what Morgan does, I mean, is really recognize that there's this interest convergence. And I say that really pointedly, because, you know, I can talk about this more later, but interest convergence being one of the underlying principles of critical race theory, right? But there's this interest convergence between white policymakers, you know, at the district level, who are looking to shore up patriotism, and then Black educators who are looking for justice, right, and representation. And so she develops this proposal for a Black history curriculum. And it really takes every part of the existing sort of K-8 curriculum and adds material to it, right? So if the students are studying ancient history, then she has, you know, material on Dahomey and other African kingdoms, right? If they're studying explorers, then she has material on Esteban or Matthew Henson or Pietro Alonso, right? But it's more than just additional material, right? It's something that's written from a different perspective. So, you know, looking at her units on slavery, they're the complete opposite of this sort of whitewashed version that was existing before her, right? She's including descriptions of the Middle Passage. She's including descriptions of the violence that underlay the slave system. She's describing resistance to slavery in the form of slave revolts and uprisings. So there's this very different approach and very different perspective that informs what she's doing that comes from this tradition of this early Black history movement. And it's really sort of a counter narrative to what's going on in the official curriculum. So I think that's the important thing to get, is that it's really sort of cutting against the grain.
Right on. Yeah, I could see that. And I just to follow up on that, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about how widely this supplementary units were adopted by educators. How were they received by teachers and students? How widely were they implemented?
So she succeeds in getting the city of Chicago to adopt the supplementary units in 1942. And so that means that it's used officially in about 353 schools in the Chicago area. But the question of how these units get used is really interesting for me as a historian and as a former K-12 teacher and current, you know, teacher at the college level, because there's always this difference between the curriculum that's intended and the curriculum that's enacted, right? There's always a difference between what gets mandated and then, you know, what teachers actually teach. So it's difficult to know precisely how faithfully teachers use this curriculum. So I don't want to act like this curriculum comes in and magically upends white supremacy in the Chicago schools, right? It doesn't do that. I'm sure that a lot of white teachers simply, you know, close their door and continue teaching whatever they want to teach without incorporating it. But even with that, right, there's a lot of evidence about the reception in Chicago and outside of it. You know, we have records of Black students. You know, one of the fun parts of writing this book was hearing the voices of Black students from the archives saying things like, you know, since I have studied Negro history, every good word about Negroes and good thing they do makes me feel swell. You know, just at one time. Yeah. At one time we were not allowed to do nothing but work night and day. And now we are doing things just as important as anybody else. It was this girl named Sandra Clark who was in the seventh grade, you know, back then. Of course, that's a pseudonym because I had to make up names for everybody. And then we have white teachers and students who are giving the same kinds of reactions. So I start the fifth chapter of the book with a story from a teacher named Grace Markwell, who is in Brookfield, right outside of Chicago. And she reads her students this story about Jan Matzleger and the shoe lasting machine. And her students are just, their minds are blown by the fact that there are Black inventors, right? And then they're even more blown when she tells them that a Black woman wrote this story about a Black inventor, right? And so her fifth graders eventually like beg her and beg her and beg her. And she lets them write a letter, which I put in the book, asking Madeline Morgan to come to their school and talk to them, right? So we know those stories and we know a little bit about the national and international reception that her work gets. I mean, thousands of people, you know, Black, white teachers, administrators, parents, soldiers fighting in the Second World War, I mean, are, you know, sending her letters requesting copies of these units. So, you know, I think her work is a success, you know, widely, but it's always difficult to see exactly the parameters of how far she got.
Mm. Wow. It's great to see the kind of progress she was able to make in that time. It's a shame that her curriculum was only an addendum to the regular course rather than, you know, the core curriculum. And I think that's a struggle we're still in today, right? To make ethnic studies a graduation requirement or part of the core curriculum rather than just an elective or an add-on. So this history just is empowering to me to hear that this struggle has happened before and we can continue in that legacy, right? So thanks for sharing those stories.
Thanks.
Yes, I love that. And I love that you're also just really lifting up the power and how profound this curriculum was for so many people and how that gets lost in history textbooks. So can you talk about some of the obstacles to the implementation of the supplementary units into the Chicago public schools and the eventual end of the intercultural movement? What was the role of McCarthyism and the Red Scare in ending it? And just as a quick note, we have a lesson to teach about McCarthyism because it's either missing or misrepresented in most textbooks. And we see those same McCarthyism era tactics and chilling effects on teachers today. So can you give us a little bit of that historical context?
Yeah, sure. I think, you know, one of the major obstacles to her movement and to the supplementary units, you know, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, is that many teachers, especially white teachers in 1940s Chicago, were simply not ready to teach this material, right? No matter what was mandated, they weren't going to do it. And some who were willing to do it were underprepared, right? They had never been taught this material before themselves. And I think that, you know, as we're speaking about echoes of today, right? You know, we can talk about teacher training, right? And equipping teachers to be able to have these types of discussions. You know, in terms of what actually spells the end of her curricular experiment, though, I think it's that the convergence of interest between white policymakers and Black educators that sort of held up during the war years begins to fade after 1945. So we have Black soldiers and white soldiers coming back home to Chicago and almost immediately starting this new war with each other, right? The 1940s, late 1940s, is this period of hidden violence in the city of Chicago, where you have all of these small scale race riots because Blacks and whites are fighting for housing, they're fighting for jobs, they're fighting for space in public parks, they're fighting for schools, right? And there's this really violent white backlash to the fact that Black folks have made some headway during the war years. And so the mayor at the time gets ousted because he's too friendly to the Black community. The superintendent at the time has his house firebombed because he's trying to end a transfer system that allowed white parents to get out of schools and flee schools if the schools became too Black, right? And then, like you said, on the national level, we're seeing the switch from fighting fascism to fighting communism, right? And so anyone who's deemed to be a little too far left is liable to be targeted, right? And so in that sort of context, I don't think a project like Madeline Morgan's was able to thrive, really.
Yeah, so you gave us so much here to discuss. So I'm really glad that there's now time to digest all that we have been talking about. So we're going to head to breakout rooms in just a second. Well, welcome back, Dr. Hines. We appreciate you being here with us.
Absolutely.
You enjoy the study, the breakout group?
I did. I got to sit in on a conversation. It was awesome. Thanks.
Yes. And I saw your note in the chat about teaching in PG County.
Yeah, I got so excited when when Prince George's got mentioned. I taught at Bladensburg High School. That was the first school I ever taught at. So shout out to Prince George's.
All right. I love it.
I first started teaching in Washington, D.C. in Anacostia, just right on the border of PG County. So
yep. And that's where I am now. So we're all connected.
I have to talk about Friendship Public Charter Schools. I taught for them for a couple of years in Anacostia.
Wow. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
What a small world.
Yes it is.
No doubt. Well, we had a couple more questions for you before we let you go. This book just is so rich and there's so many lessons to dig into, but I really appreciated something that you wrote in the introduction and that I wanted to follow up on. And you said, few Black women in early 20th century gained access to the kinds of credentials often associated with historical scholarship. And you said that Black women acted as, quote, historians without a portfolio. So I was wondering if you could say more about that and why we don't know and why most students aren't taught about these incredible figures like Madeline Morgan?
Yeah, so the phrase historians without portfolio is from a scholar named Pero Dagbovi, who's a historian of the early Black history movement. And like you were saying, it means that there are these generations of women before sort of the mid 20th century who are doing all of this incredible work, this historical work, but are going unrecognized because they don't have the PhDs, the graduate degrees, the offices on college campuses, and sort of the status symbols that are associated with, you know, quote unquote, professional historians, right? And so I think, you know, there are a lot of reasons that Madeline Morgan's story is sort of overlooked, but I think a lot of it is the intersections of her identity, right? So first, she's a Black person in America, right? Second, she's a Black woman in America. And then third, I think is really important for this story is she's a classroom educator. Mm-hmm. So on the first side, right, we know that too often the historical narratives that we tell are still centered around what historians call great man history, right? And we know that even that impacts even, right, Black historians, right? So even in the historiography of the Black freedom struggle, there's this tendency to search out charismatic male leaders, individual charismatic male leaders, right? And center those stories. So whether it's King or whether it's Malcolm or whether it's Huey or whomever, right? And then the people who don't fit within that paradigm, right, whether it's because of their gender, whether it's because of their sexuality, whether it's for other reasons, they don't get the attention that they deserve. And so I'm thinking right now about pioneers like Pauli Murray, right, or Bayard Rustin, who are so critical, right, to the movement, who are just now getting their due. And then in the history of the Black educational struggle, it means that we often center men like, you know, W.E.B. Du Bois or Carter G. Woodson, Booker T. Washington, right? Those are the names that grab sort of the most headlines and the most attention, even though it's these thousands of Black women who are out here for the most part enacting those visions, right, and creating their own visions, but they get left out. And then, you know, lastly, I would say, you know, tied to that for Morgan is the fact that she's a classroom teacher, right? And that's a group that often, you know, still gets overlooked in our conversations about who are, you know, who has power, who are historical actors when it comes to education. I taught education policy for several years at Loyola University Chicago while I was doing my graduate training. And I would start the semester off by asking my students, and these are all teachers and teacher candidates, right, in the teacher ed program. I would ask them, you know, who makes education policy, right? Who affects change in schools? And they would tell me everyone but teachers, right? I almost had to drag the word teachers out of them, right? They would say, you know, nonprofits and government agencies and politicians and lawmakers and parents and, right? And way down at the bottom of the list, even for them, was teachers. And so I think that, you know, the stories of classroom teachers being centered is something that needs to happen more in the histories that we tell to incoming educators, to educators who are already out in the field, because it really changes the dynamic.
Yes, yes, yes to all of that. And just loving how you're lifting up the power of classroom teachers and the knowledge that they hold and continue to pour, not only into the curriculum and the pedagogy, but also the policy, the activism, the organizing, that we can learn so much from classroom teachers. And you also made me think about this quote from Monique Kufsen. She said, Black women, they know what they know, and they know that they know it. And that sticks with me, particularly as you're lifting up the power and the intersections of that experience that then lends them to a type of knowledge. And so one thing that you also wrote, you said her reliance, so Madeline Morgan's reliance on scholarly communities outside of the boundaries of the school system, including local history clubs, libraries, sororities, and civil rights groups, highlights the robust networks of support and sustenance that remain, although in different forms, in the present. And that makes me think about the Teaching for Black Lives study groups, right? We just heard from two facilitators, two leaders. There's many leaders on the call. I'm thinking about Zen Education Project and Rethinking Schools Educators and Black Lives Matter at School Educators that I'm in community with, DC Area Educators for Social Justice, shout out, just all of these groups of folks that I get to learn with outside of the academic space and all of the teachers that I get to learn from their pedagogy. And so can you talk about the networks of support that Madeline Morgan leaned into, and how did that shape her? How did that shape her activism and her teaching?
Yeah. So I think you're spot on. One of the big takeaways from this project for me was the power of these networks of teachers that are outside of the formal system. So, you know, in the 1920s, 1930s, when Madeline was coming up, it was, you know, Black teachers associations. It was very powerfully Black sororities and fraternities. Right. It was the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History, you know, the NAACP, the Urban League. Right. It was women's clubs like the NACW and the NCNW. So you have these layers and layers and layers of organizing sort of on top of one another that she can draw from. And I'm really interested in what that looks like today. And you've named some of the ways that that's still out there. I think that, you know, like Lee Patel says, right, the sort of study and struggle are always being intertwined, right? So there are these spaces that are still existing where people are doing the work of studying, the hard work of studying, and it's informing the struggle. So I think out here in the Bay Area where I am now, I think of things like the Oakland Black Teacher Project, right? When I was in Chicago, it was, you know, it was about the Surge Institute, which is this sort of like amazing network of Black and Brown educators. And then, you know, to hear you talk about the study groups through Zen Ed and some of the programs in DC. Yeah, it's just one of the reasons that I was really happy to be here, because this is the sort of thing that is continuing that legacy and continuing to build those networks of support.
Right on. Are there other teachers like Madeline that we should know about? I mean, and if you think of other ones later, we can always add them to the email we send to teachers. But if there's some off the top that we should begin to look into, yeah. I'd be curious.
Yeah. I mean, so many, teachers need their due and need their stories written. You know, so when I was doing this archival work in Chicago, you know, going back to the networks, I was sort of mapping out who Madeline was in conversation with, right? Who are her mentors? Who are her, you know, associates? Who is she running with, right? And that's everybody from like the Bridge Club at the church where she, you know, plays on Sundays, you know, up to like formal organizations, right? And so I ran into just an amazing group of women. So you talk about Maudell Blousfield, who's the first Black principal in the Chicago public schools, who's really like an older sister figure to Madeline, or Oneida Cockrell, who's the head of Phi Delta Kappa sorority, the chapter that Madeline is in. And then there's this whole, you know, this scholarship is just starting to take off, but there's a whole unexplored world of Black librarians and archivists that still need their stories told as well. So there's women like Vivian Harsh and Charlamagne Rollins. Vivian Harsh was the head librarian at the George Cleveland Hall branch of the Chicago Public Library. Charlamagne Rollins was the children's librarian. And they both, you know, made this library in Chicago this hub and this bastion for Black history. And it's where Madeline goes to do a lot of the research for the curriculum that she writes, right? So, you know, the idea now that's being called liberation archives, right? Who are the archives and librarians and archivists that are creating these liberation archives that are then fueling the wider movement? And giving those women their due, I think is really important. So shout outs to the librarians. And then nationally, I mean, there are women, Jane Dabney Shackelford, Constance Ridley Hislip, Velina G. Higginbotham. I mean, it's, I could go on, but these are all women that need to be explored and need to have their stories told too. They're all part of the same movement and the same historical moment. Yeah.
Oh, that's great. I know we have a lot of researchers and educators right here with us that will dig into some of those names. I love it.
Yes, I was trying to scribble down all of those names, and I hope that we all can just give librarians their flowers too. I think about so many experiences going to the library and it opening up new perspectives for me and new possibilities. So I just am appreciative and grateful to you for lifting that up as part of this rich tradition and this legacy. And so on that note, Madeline Morgan once said, knowledge is only power if it's put into action. Love that quote. So what lessons can we gain from how Madeline Morgan organized? And how does her story better help us understand how to build a struggle against current legislative attacks on Black education and Black history?
So I think the easiest answer, the most simple answer, is that it really highlights the power of teachers. And of teacher networks like we've been talking about. And so this work that we're doing here is a continuation of the things that people like Madeline Morgan were doing, you know, almost a century ago, right? And so if nothing else, I think we can be heartened by the fact that, you know, this is not the first time that we've seen this stuff, right? So Jesse, you were saying when we were talking about racist curricula, right, that some of the things that were going on in the 30s are really like echoed in some of the things, you know, like Florida stuff today. So when you see, you know, slavery portrayed as something where enslaved people learned, you know, quote unquote, valuable skills, right? Knowing that that's not the first time, right? And that this isn't random either, right? It's not a mistake. It's not random. It's not just one sentence. Right. It's part of an attack that's been ongoing for generations, for decades. Right. It's part of a historical narrative that's been there for a long time and that we have to fight back against and push back against. So I think drawing from the history in that way is important. I think another thing that really stood out for me is that, you know, better curriculum can't be additive, right? It can't be something that's at the margins. You know, the reason why Morgan's curriculum didn't take is because it didn't replace what came before. So it was too easy for policymakers to sort of abandon it when the political winds shifted and when their priorities shifted. And, you know, she even saw that after the war, and she worked for a bill in Illinois that would have codified Black history as a requirement for graduation in her home state. And, you know, unfortunately, when that bill went to the House, it was modified. The language was modified, right? And it went from a must to a may, or a must to a can, right? If they want to, and we all know what happens after that, right? It makes it largely symbolic. It takes away any of the teeth, right? So I think that, you know, this work that we're doing has to be done from the ground up. It can't be around the margins, right? We can't sort of nibble around the margins. We've got to uproot the curriculum and replace it from the ground up.
Yeah. Well, thank you for doing all this research and letting us all in on this vital history. Like, so many people here this evening are not just studying this history passively, but doing exactly what Madeline Morgan said in terms of putting it into action, right? And there are people here not only teaching anti-racist curriculum, but also part of the movement to teach truth and fight against these laws. And I think we're all stronger in this struggle now that we've learned this history. And I hope that everybody will go get this book immediately and read the details and really get to know Madeline Morgan in a way you can only do reading this book. So thanks so much for being with us this evening.
All right. Thank you too. And thanks to everybody who came out. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you for joining us today. This podcast is brought to you by the Zen Education Project, coordinated by Teaching for Change and Rethinking Schools.
Music provided by The Blue Tide, a Seattle-based acoustic blues duo of Daniel Rapport and JD Lenore, aka Jesse Hagopian. You can find them on Spotify, Apple Music, or wherever you get your music.